Today's episode of The Scathing Atheist is brought to you by the new brand of designer chainmail armor for children, Joshkosh Bagosh. So when there's an army of genocidal Jews circling silently at the city gates, make sure your children are dressed in the coolest new sword-proof, fireproof, hailstone-proof, machine-washable armor. Joshkosh Bagosh, because God hates you and you're going to die. And now, The Scathing Atheist.
You know what they do in San Francisco, some of the gay community, they want to get people, so if they've got the stuff, they'll have a ring, you shake hands, and the ring's got a little thing where you cut your finger.
Really?
Yeah, really. I mean, it's that kind of vicious stuff, which would be the equivalent of murder.
Hello, I'm Mike Dunlap of MikeDunlapPhotography.com. As someone who has studied and photographed the human form for over 20 years, I can tell you that we did, in fact, evolve from filthy monkey men.
Thursday, it's August 29th, and atheists do it with larger, evolutionarily superior genitalia. I'm your host, No Illusions, and from well-hung New York, New York, this is The Scathing Atheist. On this week's episode, the Pope raises eyebrows with his new Don't Tell, Don't Tell policy on sex abuse, a high school in Indonesia will consider a new virgin fingering policy, and Lucinda will join us to talk divine land reapportionment. But first, the diatribe. Ever want to feel really old? Take somebody whose diaper you once changed and then watch them change their kid's diaper. My wife had the opportunity to do exactly that last week when she flew down to Georgia to meet her niece's brand new baby girl. Now, she doesn't get to see her family very often, so our six-year-old nephew spent most of the week clinging to her leg in one manner or another. So one night, she's hanging out with him, and he's looking for excuses not to go to bed. He's got a bunch of planets on his wall, so he starts asking her, which planet is that? Which one is that? And before long, she's got her laptop fired up, and she's showing him Cassini pictures and Voyager images and close-ups of coronal mass ejections, and he's eating it up. She shows him the Hubble Deep Field image, and his eyes just linger in unchecked amazement when she tells him that every point of light he sees is another galaxy with billions or even trillions of stars. It takes him a second to even think how to respond, and when he does, the question is fucking heartbreaking. How many miles is it to heaven? If I'd been there, I might have accidentally ruined the next six Thanksgivings by saying something like, heaven is from religion, these pictures are from reality. But Lucinda's a bit more diplomatic than me, so she answered as well as it probably could have been answered. She said, we've seen billions of light years away from Earth, but we've still never seen heaven. That's a pretty good answer, I guess, if your goal is not alienating your family, but it's still a sad damn shame that she's got to settle for that. It's a damn shame that at the age of six, this kid's natural curiosity is already being stifled by a ridiculously antiquated view of the universe. Even at six, he's encountering things that can't be made to fit into his biblical worldview. He has to work harder to get to the right answer because he's got to weave his way through this maze of bullshit to get there. You know, the world is already pretty damn hard to wrap your head around at the age of six. It's a lot harder when you've got to reconcile the Adam and Eve myth with the existence of dinosaurs and recessive genes. When you've got to develop a grand unified theory of history that's two parts history and one part Jewish revenge porn. When you've got to stop in the middle of an astronomy lesson to ask where heaven fits into all of this. If you think back to your own childhood, you can probably come up with a memory where you were trying to pound the square peg of mythology into the round hole of science. Christians love to defend their little fairy tales by telling us that they're allegories, but when they pull that shit, ask them if they make that clear to their children. If they don't start out the Bible story for their kids with, here's a fairy tale about Jesus, then it's only an allegory once you get too smart to believe it's true, and that doesn't fucking count. The saddest thing is that this kid's mother isn't even particularly religious. She doesn't go to church, I've never seen her pray, she's certainly read less of the Bible in her lifetime than I read this week, but she's still just religious enough to hamstring her son's education. It's not deliberate, of course, she just believes that religion is good for her kids, because people with every reason to lie say so. Now, don't get me wrong, there are plenty of more reprehensible forms of child abuse that take place in the name of religion. Even if you set aside the sexual and physical abuse that religion is used to justify, you'd still have that wide spectrum of psychological abuses, from tormenting kids with images of hell to confusing the shit out of them with a prehistoric notion of sexual morality. But there's just something about taking a huge steaming shit on a child's curiosity that really pisses me off.
They're talking about your Jesus.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin.
Joining me for headlines tonight is my fellow Tenable Stance junkie, Heath Enright. Heath, are you ready to discuss several more ways religion was stupid and indefensible in the news this week?
I am. When you live and die for a math textbook that says 2 plus 2 is 5, you manage to get all sorts of other shit wrong, too. Unbelievable. Sometimes your big brother's dumb and shitty at math. Just accept it.
Yeah, all the 1 equals 3 shit was a dead giveaway, if you ask me. In our lead story tonight, the Vatican has finally taken a decisive move to ensure a radical decrease in allegations of sex crimes against the clergy. They made reporting those crimes illegal.
Aren't there easier ways to solve this? Couldn't they just give all the priests vasectomies, cut the DNA evidence problem off the source, just ban the word no in the Vatican so there's never technically a consent issue? Like I've said before, Catholics could just stop having children and that would solve it too.
It's a good idea. I like that. So there were plenty of rumors already swirling when word came down last week that Pope Frankie Valli was bringing the Vatican legal system up to date by criminalizing leaks of official information at the same time that he was formalizing the laws about sex crimes.
That's up to date, okay.
So it turns out one law ensures that allegations of sex crimes are confidential, and the other makes it illegal to disperse confidential information.
There's no such thing as a private allegation. That doesn't exist. That's just a person thinking to themselves, I'm kind of mad about getting raped, I think. I'm not going to say anything out loud about this, but internally, I'm, you know, silently a little miffed about the rape.
Vatican Foreign Minister Monsignor Dominique Mamberti actually had the audacity to pretend that they were all, like, really disheartened when they learned that they'd accidentally made it illegal to report sex abuse. He said, and before quoting this, I think I should emphasize that this is actually a real quote, quote, it's quite a papal pickle that His Holiness has placed upon our heads.
Really? All right. It's time for tip of the miter, wag of the pickle. Go.
I mean, wasn't it placing pickles in people's heads that started this whole problem?
Head-scratching behavior. Probably because of all the crabs. Itchy stuff.
Look, if I wanted somebody to find that sausage, I wouldn't have hidden it in the first place.
When in Rome, don't be surprised to get an unsolicited Roman helmet. And for those listeners who aren't familiar with this terminology, when I say Roman helmet, I'm suggesting the Pope would straddle you backwards and rest his balls over your eyes and the shaft over your nose, thus resembling the old Roman war helmet thingy. You guys can picture this.
So, and from the unconsciously regulate your endocrine levels if you saw that coming file, a recent measles outbreak in Texas has been traced back to an anti-vaccination megachurch. Pastor, faith healer, and sentient excrement Kenneth Copeland of the Eagle Mountain International Church in North Texas is a vocal proponent of the thoroughly debunked, discredited, disproven, disparaged, and disgraced notion that the MMR vaccine causes autism.
Oh, this again.
This theory is so indefensible it might as well be biblical.
I can't believe the church finally decided to base an opinion on a scientific study, and the doctor whose study they went with was Andrew fucking Wakefield.
Yeah.
Andrew Wakefield. Dr. Dre and Dr. Mario have more respect in the medical community. Unbelievable.
So when the inevitable outbreak of fully preventable childhood diseases struck, the church sent out a rapid-fire series of excuses ranging from the CDC is secretly infecting people with measles to discredit us to, well, measles aren't really that bad now, are they?
What had happened is we sent out a pamphlet with measles preventing prayer, but there was a typo on one of the important magic words. So everybody was saying it wrong.
There you
Plus,
go.
There was a shortage of unicorn hair this year. So lots of people never even got their wands. I don't know why you guys are blaming us. It's an act of God. There were no unicorns.
What are you going to do?
Zero. They don't exist.
Now, as much as I'd love to say that anybody who gets measles after taking medical advice from a used snake oil salesman deserves it, the problem with the anti-vax crowd is that the victims are the communities that surround these idiots, not to mention their own fucking children.
Indeed.
And in criminal possession of reason news tonight, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has ruled that California atheist Barry Hazel Jr. is owed some compensatory damages after being sent to jail for not believing in God. And yes, that's pretty much exactly what happened.
Dude's name has too many syllables to be the atheist protest mantra, though. Free right. Barry Hazel Jr. Free Barry Hazel Jr. It just fucking doesn't work.
It doesn't. So anyway, this unchantable assailant served a brief jail term for minor drug offenses, and upon release, he's ordered to participate in an addiction recovery program. Of course, this is one of those 12-step put-your-faith-in-a-higher-power programs. So Hazel, to his credit, actually attended the program, but he requested a secular alternative, and the court told him to fuck off.
Yeah, God forbid you sober up through empirically tested means. No, seriously, God forbids that. Can't kick the habit without bad metaphysics, that's the rule.
And judging from the estimate of AA's success rate, you can't kick them with bad metaphysics either. So anyway, after the staff at this 12-step program reported that this guy's being disruptive in, quote, a congenial way, he's taken out of the program and sentenced to a further 100 days in jail, and in addition, he was denied access to Go and the customary $200.
What do they even mean, being disruptive in a congenial way? He was probably just telling really good jokes, and even the staff started laughing when they probably shouldn't have.
Right.
Particularly offensive, but they cracked as well. Listen, if you send an atheist stoner to an NA meeting, he's going to make sarcastic comments. It's impossible not to. Rehab for minor drug offenses and God are ridiculous notions. If we don't mock you there, we can actually burst into flame if we're not careful.
Anything is possible. So, of course, he sues the state, and of course he won. But he was awarded $0 in damages by a jury of his peers because apparently his peers are a bunch of Christian blowhard assholes. The judge throws out the non-award and immediately set about impaneling a new jury with fewer weasel turds on it, luckily.
That's how the awards process works? Isn't that stupid? Why not award him negative $10,000? I mean, it seems a little bit unreasonable.
And from the They Meant Freedom of My Religion file, some Christians in Kansas are going apeshit over a religious display in a school, but not because it's a religious display in a school. That's okay. The problem here is that they picked the wrong religion. The display in question was a banner with five images of pillars that read the five pillars of Islam, and that sounds pretty damning when you don't know the details.
And Christians are all about not knowing the details. But out of context, you've got to admit, vertical pillar-like shapes, that's pretty offensive. I mean, those five pillars could be used to perform 2.5 crucifixions. Kids are just supposed to ignore that fact right in front of their face.
So the story begins when somebody snapped a picture of the banner and posted it on Facebook with the caption, "This is a school that has banned all forms of Christian prayer. This cannot stand." And with the penchant for fact-checking that we've come to expect from angry meme-spreading Christians, this shit went as viral as Miley's vagina.
She had to eventually get herpes, though. I mean, anybody sired by a grown man with two first names and a rat tail? Come on.
I don't know if I buy that. How could herpes survive inside that vagina? Anyway, quick two-point reality check here. Number one, this school, along with all other schools in the fucking country, doesn't ban all forms of Christian prayer. They just ban the ones where kids are forced to go along. And number two, acknowledging that religion exists in a school isn't against the law. It's the part where you start pushing it on kids as though it was true that we have laws against.
Did you say reality check? You might have lost their attention between the word reality and the word check. These are people who are offended by visual reminders of things that exist. So
might be giving them too much credit.
Indeed.
And finally tonight, and I guess you can't just saran wrap your vagina, can you, news? A school in Sumatra has proposed a virginity test for all their female students.
What a great job, though. Virginity tester. I'd sign up. Did she pass? Nope. Wait, anal? Hold on. Another minute. Also, no. What about her? Nope. Next. Pretty much never pass. I'm a tough grader. I'm selective.
Education Chief Mohammed Rashid proposed the idea that he described as, quote, an accurate way to protect children from prostitution and free sex.
Wait. Prostitution and free sex. If there's one thing we don't want, it's paid sex. And if there's another thing we don't want, it's unpaid sex. Can't prove your virginity without taking a cock. Can't take a cock without losing your virginity. Seems like a regular snatch 22 here. I don't know what they're going to do.
So setting aside for a second the fact that there's no actual way to test a woman for virginity, how fucked up does your brain have to be to think that the best way to protect women from prostitution is denying an education to the sexually active teenage ones? And on that mental conundrum, we're going to close off the headlines tonight. Heath, thanks as always.
Pleasure.
And when we come back, we'll recount a biblical massacre, or 31. Joshua, oh Joshua, that genocidal idol. He's the baddest motherfucker that we've met yet in the Bible. He's like a biblical Batman. If Batman killed babies. Imagine if he gave Wolverine adamantium rabies. This badass says chop off your foreskin and people actually do. He's like a Jedi. In that his story isn't factually true. Like Superman, he's invincible and he wins every battle, but unlike the Man of Steel, he kills the women and cattle. He's like the Hulk, but with Thor's hammer and a magical arc. The sun needs his permission before it's allowed to get dark. He's like a Bronze Age Jackie Chan. He even kicks ass with dumb shit like his notorious chorus and nuclear trumpets. He's the Bible's Bruce Lee, but with triple the skill. He's never met an innocent bystander that he didn't kill. With a swipe of his sword, he could knock the wings off a gnat. He could take out all four Ninja Turtles and that mutated rat. When you learn about this guy, it's hard not to conclude that Chuck Norris impregnated the Dos Equis dude. He's admirable. He's lovable. He's strong. He's heroic. As long as you haven't updated your morals since the Paleozoic. Joshua, oh Joshua, Moses finally died so that you could have the position that so long you had eyed. You served bravely as vice Jew, but the time's come, alas, after too many decades of kissing God's ass, to take the baton and lead this army of Jews. After all, there are Canaanites in need of abuse. You served God well by scouting and then not being honest, so you'll lead the Hebrews to the land that God promised. Your ambitions are grand, your intentions extortionate, so with your God-given powers of land reapportionment, you're going to be crossing a river, but you won't need to float. When God's done with that shit, you'd have to carry your boat. Where to go? Jericho. I hear they've got hookers. You promise not to kill Rahab, and she's quite a looker. I mean, you might as well, since you're killing all the Gentile chicks, and there's no way those Jewish princesses are sucking your dick. Joshua, oh Joshua, how your legend ascends, the way you massacre, exterminate, and ethnically cleanse. You're the bravest, the strongest, and usually the smartest, except when dealing with Gibeons, those fucking con artists. Hanging kings, burning villages, your army sets forth, from Akan to Ai, and then continuing north. Killing children to show what a shit you don't give, but showing occasional mercy by letting animals live. With the slightest of setbacks, your conquest succeeds, ensuring that millions will boast of your deeds. You're a legend, a lion, a genuine stud. They took your milk and your honey, and you took their blood.
The Holy Babel.
Ah, Joshua, the redundant geography lesson of the Old Testament. Half exaltation of genocide, half property auction listing. This book has all the intrigue of GPS directions, all the civility of YouTube comments, and all the morality of a Nuremberg indictment. So to help me sort through the fallen bodies, I'm joined by my lovely wife, Lucinda. Lucinda, welcome back.
Pleasure to be here.
And, of course, not actually having gone anywhere since we recorded the headline segment is Heath. Heath, thanks for not escaping when you had the chance.
Yo, yo, still here. Heath has not left the building.
So basically, the book of Joshua describes the glorious war crimes that Joshua committed in order to fulfill God's belated promises of land.
Yeah, because it's not like God could just divinely create more land for the Jews that wasn't full of people they needed to kill or anything. Seriously, did he run out of milk and honey or something? I don't understand.
Look, I already made you guys a promised land. It's right there. Milk, honey, vineyards, a bagel and schmear, the whole spread. You just need to fumigate.
And fumigate they do. So let's just dive in, shall we?
Upon Moses' death, God passes the torch to Joshua, which is a lot like Lord Vader putting you in command of the fleet. A little nerve-wracking.
Right. God says, you are invincible. Nobody can defeat you. But don't forget to be brave. How brave exactly can an invincible person be, really?
Right.
Good headline here. Son of Nun supports the habit.
Oh, well done. Lines. In chapter 2, Joshua sends a couple of spies across the Jordan, and they're just about to start spying when they decide to fuck some whores instead.
Joshua says to his spies, go check out Jericho. And they're like, dude, that's perfect. The whorehouse is right on the way. In-N-Out Furburger. We're clearly stopping at In-N-Out Furburger. Jericho should be a pushover. The king of Jericho finds out Joshua sends spies. He's like, get that slut Rahab on the phone and tell her to be on the lookout for penises that are most likely horribly mangled by primitive foreskin removal. Little did he know, right, the crafty tribe had conveniently forgot about that rule for a few decades. More on that later.
Yeah, and in chapter 3, Joshua feels like he has to prove himself to be truly Mosaic, so he parts the Jordan. Couldn't come up with his own magic trick or anything, guys. He just totally ripped off Moses.
Right.
Not original at all. Oregon Trail would have been a lot easier if he could be a Jewish prophet at the beginning.
Oh, nice.
Instead of the Boston banker, Ohio carpenter, Illinois farmer. Be the Jewish prophet. Never have to risk caulking the wagon, fording the river. You always die.
Right. Right. We learn about the 12 magic Joshua stones. And is it just me, or does this thing occasionally read kind of like a tourist guide?
Awful.
I mean, with that, and they are there to this day crap, it's almost like the people writing this didn't realize somebody would actually be reading it 3,000 years later.
And wouldn't that just be the easiest way to fuck up the whole biblical inerrancy thing? I mean, you grab one of those guys, take him to the stones, plunk one in the river, and say, where's your Bible now, bitch?
Right. So the entire army crosses the Jordan into hostile territory, and 10 seconds after God fills it back in, he says, oh, you know what? Why don't you guys do some cosmetic penis surgery real quick before going to war for me?
I'm getting a lot of pleasure sensations from my upper penis area. Does anybody have a flint knife?
Gross.
And then they do the divine conga line around Jericho for a little while. So for like a week, there's a ring of Jews walking silently around the town, and all the people behind the walls are thinking, this is the shittiest parade ever. And then,
suspicious.
Of course, trumpet blows, walls come crashing down, they kill everybody except the whore and her family.
And man, do they. Chapter 6, verse 21. Then they devoted to destruction by the edge of their sword, all in the city, both men and women, young and old, oxen and sheep and donkeys, even the talking ones, I'm sure.
So on to chapter 7, which reeks of revisionism. After God says, go kick ass, you are invincible, they lose the second fight they get into. So Joshua's all like, hey, bro, what happened to the invincible before my enemies thing? And God's all, somebody took some silver and hid it, so all bets are off.
So they go and they find the dude who did it. He confesses. So they mercifully set him and his family on fire and stone their burning bodies to death. And that kind of shit makes God really happy, by the way.
I said you could rape, but only the Levites can pillage and plunder. I specifically said raping only for the rest of you. But the free non-consensual pussy wasn't good enough, was it? You're in God's fucking army. Act accordingly. There's a line. And it's somewhere between rape and stealing silver. Rape's on the right side of this line for him. Stealing the silver was the problem. Just to clarify, rape, right side, stealing silver, the problem.
That's all right then.
And then they go back to the town that had just kicked their asses because God's on their side again now. But interesting that despite that, they also had to send 10 times as many people and work out an elaborate ambush.
And, of course, kill all the men, women, and children. But you can tell that God's in a way better mood this time because he lets the livestock live.
Then the residents of Gibeon heard about the approaching wave of genocide, so they trick Joshua into sparing them and just making them slaves by pretending to be from a far-off country.
Yeah, they were damn tricky about it, too. They're showing them moldy bread, and they're saying, look, this was fresh loaf when we left.
Right.
How could we possibly have moldy bread if we weren't foreigners?
They're tight.
Yeah.
And I love that Joshua asks him later, why did you trick me? You were going to kill them, you asshole. Why the fuck wouldn't they trick you?
Not get murdered. That's why.
That was the motivation.
It's the classic old two-for-flinching Rodney King conundrum thing, you know? You swing a nightstick, and then you yell, stop resisting arrest, when they hold up their hand and block it. Classic.
Chapter 10 probably contains the most ass-kicking of any chapter in the Bible so far. I mean, this is where Joshua pretty much wipes out the whole country. Hell, God starts hurling stones at the opposing armies at one point, and when they try to flee, Joshua orders God not to let the sun set so that they can pursue them better.
It's so awful. The book just keeps bragging about how thorough the genocide was.
Right.
It's got to be so uncomfortable for Christians. It's like bragging to your friend's wife about how hot his mistress is.
It was a decent genocide, but how thorough were you guys? Really. Collateral damage is Joshua's middle name. It's Joshua, collateral damage, Jew, or Nunsin, whatever.
So then Joshua's army kills more people, and then they go back to the armyless towns, kill all the women and children, steal all the valuables, and, on occasion, burn the cities to the ground.
Chapter 12 is basically a scorecard that compares Moses and Joshua when it comes to murdering of the monarchs. As it turns out, Joshua won by a very long shot.
Also, for the record, if you present the information from a table with two columns, and the entry is the same for an entire column, you don't need a fucking table at that point. And if you write it all out, which makes even less sense, you don't have to repeat the number one over and over like that.
Yeah.
And then this book abruptly stops being remotely interesting. So just when you're thinking that you're settling into a book full of merciless bloodshed, we take a hard right into the minutes of a Bronze Age community rezoning board.
Okay, we murdered all the people. I believe you promised us some land. It's not like we're fucking chosen over here or something. Pony up.
Right. For four chapters, we get poorly formed GPS directions and a few stories of slightly less thorough slaughters.
Plus some incest.
Of course.
Naturally. As you're reading the shit, you can't help but wonder, though, how this book ever led to a land dispute.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. How is that a problem these days?
Exactly.
Unbelievable.
They set up the cities of refuge, by the way, that are these lovely little towns full of unavenged murderers.
What is this? If stupid shit in your holy book leads to a whole bunch of accidental murders? So much so that entire manslaughter cities were necessary? You might want to scrap the draft. Go back to the drawing board. Shitty book. God. All right, so let's move on to chapter 23. We're on the way home from the war now, and the Reubenites and the Gadites build a statue, you know, to commemorate their part in the genocidal mission from God. They're very proud of being involved. And that's like talking about Fight Club to the Israelites, or Smite Club, or whatever they got going. So the Israelites decide it's a reasonable time to go to war with them over it now.
Yeah, but luckily they all sit down and talk and agree that they all still believe in the same magical sky man, or all hell might have broken loose.
Disaster averted. And then Joshua reminds them one more time not to piss off God, and he dies. And they bury him. And apparently they've been carrying Joseph's bones around this whole time, and they bury those too? What?
Yeah, and then the very last verse of the whole thing is about Eliezer dying. I mean,
right? Where the fuck did that come from?
Right, this is some minor character forgotten that this whole thing ends with, and Eliezer, son of Aaron, he's dead too.
Amen.
Now, I do have to admit that this book gave us a much-needed closure. It managed to tie the whole first six books together and make you feel kind of like you've been reading one long story for a minute. So I was actually impressed by it from a literary perspective.
Yeah, not so much from a moral perspective.
No. Yeah. It was probably the least moral thing we've come across yet, and that's saying something after Leviticus and Numbers.
And Genesis, Exodus, Deuteronomy, everything we ever discuss on this show.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, we'll be in a biblical detox for a couple of weeks, but we'll be tackling Judges in about 3 weeks, so you'll have plenty of time to get caught up if you hate yourself. So, Lucinda, thanks for joining us.
Anytime.
And Heath, happy motherfucking birthday, bro.
Yeah, happy birthday.
2 to the 5th.
Before we count down the registers tonight, I wanted to give a quick shout out to all the participants in the Fantasy Football League of Sinister Secularists. It's a league that Carl from Post-Rapture Looting and I cooked up, made up entirely of secular podcasters and bloggers. So to Carl, Thomas from Thomas and the Bible, Cecil from Cognitive Dissonance, Mark from BeSecular.org, Bill and his son Sean from Barroom Atheists, Evan from The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, Jesse from wherever the hell Carl found her, and of course Heath from 84 Seconds Ago, I want to say good luck on the weeks when you're not playing me, and may you be humble in your inevitable defeat. If you have even a passing interest in which podcaster and or blogger reigns supreme, I'll be keeping everybody posted on the blog at SkatingAtheist.com, and if you have no interest in that whatsoever, I'll also be putting other stuff on the blog as well. Of course, I need to thank Lucinda for lending us her wit, her insight, and her angelic voice tonight. I need to thank Heath, as always, but even more than usual this time because he stayed up till the crack of dawn after his birthday party to work on the headline segment. Goes above and beyond, folks. I also need to thank Michael Dunlop from MichaelDunlopPhotography.com for providing this week's Farnsworth quote. You'll find a link to his website on the show notes for this episode. But most of all, we need to extend our deepest gratitude to this week's most irreplaceable corporeal forms, Pekka, Cheryl, Thomas, Steve, David, other Steve, Matt, and Alden. Pekka, Cheryl, and Thomas, whose lightning quick fists seem sluggish compared to their wit. Steve, David, and other Steve, whose boundless generosity seems slight compared to their intellects. And Matt and Alden, whose humility is in constant conflict with their behemoth genitals. These 8 brave and valiant exemplars of godlessness have cemented their legend this week by giving us money. Not everybody has the cunning, gallantry, and expendable income required to give us money, but if you think you're worthy to stand beside such virtuous individuals as Pekka, Cheryl, Thomas, Steve, David, other Steve, Matt, and Alden, you'll find the donate button on the right side of our homepage at scathingatheist.com. And if you want to help out, but donating money is against your irreligion, you can also help us out by giving us a sterling review on iTunes or whatever you use. You can also inflate our sense of self-worth by liking us on Facebook, following us on Twitter, and subscribing to our YouTube channel and our aforementioned blog. That's all the blasphemy we have for you tonight, but if you want more, there's more. Steve at the A Matter of Doubt podcast invited me on for a chat the other day. No definitive word on when that episode will be up, but as soon as I know, I'll be sharing it on all those social media sites you are now planning on liking, following, and subscribing to us on. If you have questions, comments, or death threats, you're going to find all the contact info on the contact page at scathingatheist.com. All the music used in this episode was written and performed by yours truly, and yes, I did have my permission. you said the free consensual pussy.
Oh.
You want non-consensual.
Yeah. Oh.